This is a production of Cornell University.
Good evening, and welcome to the last of the summer lecture series. It's been a great series. How many people have been to all four, including this one? Oh, good, good, good. That's terrific. My name is Charles Jeremy, and I'm with the School of Continuing Education, which is usually up here, but I don't know, Matt doesn't have the slide up here. I have a question tonight. How many of you as children wondered why 3.14159 was not called cake? Well, if you did wonder that, you're not going to find out the answer tonight. Stephen Strogatz is the Jacob Gould Sherman Professor of Applied Mathematics at Cornell University. He holds a joint appointment in the College of Arts and Sciences and Mathematics and in the College of Engineering and Mechanical and Aerospace Engineering. He's a mathematics graduate from Princeton, and his doctoral work in applied mathematics was done at Harvard. Before he came to Cornell, he taught in MIT's Department of Mathematics from 1989 to 1994. Steve works in the areas of nonlinear dynamics and complex systems, often on topics inspired by the curiosities of everyday life. He is perhaps best known for his 1998 Nature paper on small world networks, co-authored with his former student, Duncan Watts. And for those of us whose math abilities are really sketchy, as I understand it, social networks and the connectivity of the internet and Wikipedia and gene networks all exhibit small network characteristics. As one measure of that paper's influence, it was the most highly cited paper about networks between 1998 and 2008 across all scientific disciplines, as well as the sixth most highly cited paper on any topic in physics. Steve has received many awards for his research, teaching, and public service, including a Presidential Young Investigator Award from NSF, MIT's highest teaching prize, and four teaching awards from the College of Engineering. He is also the recipient of the Communications Award from the Joint Policy Board for Mathematics, a Lifetime Achievement Award for the communication of mathematics to the general public, and he still has lots of life in him. In 2009, he was elected a Fellow of the Society for Industrial and Applied Mathematics for his, quote, investigations of small world networks and coupled oscillators and for outstanding science communication. In 2012, he was elected a Fellow of the American Academy of Arts and Sciences. Steve has been a frequent guest on National Public Radio's Radio Lab. In the spring of 2010, he wrote a weekly column in the New York Times. The Harvard Business Review described these columns as, quote, must reads for entrepreneurs and executives who grasp that mathematics is now the lingua franca of serious business analysis, and, quote, a model for how mathematics needs to be popularized. Steve has also filmed a series of 24 lectures on the topic of chaos for the Teaching Company's Great Courses series, available on DVD. He is the author of Nonlinear Dynamics and Chaos, Sync, The Calculus of Friendship, and his most recent book, The Joy of X, will appear in October. Steve Strogatz, doing math in public. Thank you.
Thanks very much, Bud, for that very nice introduction. And thank you all for coming. It's very encouraging to think that so many people like math. But also the air conditioning, I know, is very nice in here. So either way, it's fine. Glad to see you. The stories I want to tell you tonight got started. Oh, is this still on? Is that making all that noise? No. Yeah. The story is is almost exactly 3 years old. And I know that because I remember the day when all of this began, which was my 50th birthday, August 13th of 2009. Yeah, that would add up right. So on that day, by accident, or not accident exactly, but just by coincidence, I was having lunch with the op-ed editor of the New York Times. Now, that's not a regular kind of thing that I would do. It's just that I had written some op-eds for him over the years, and he said, next time you're in New York, look me up. So I thought, I will. And, you know, I mean, why not? So I said, I'll be around such and such day. He said, okay, this day. Meet me at the Oyster Bar in Grand Central Station. And so I didn't know what it was about, but we sat down. He didn't know it was my birthday. I never mentioned that to him. But anyway, so we started to talk, and he said, would you ever have time to write a series about math for the, as he put it, for the page, you know, for the New York Times op-ed page? So I thought, that sounds amazingly exciting. And as it happened, I didn't have any courses to teach that spring, because I was had taught was going to be teaching them all that fall. So I said, yes, I could do it this spring of 2010. And he said, great, let's do it. So what would a math series look like? And so the way I want to do this talk tonight is to have a conversation with you rather than me just lecturing. And so from time to time, I'm going to pose questions that are meant to be real questions, not rhetorical. That is, you will make me happy if you answer them and give opinions and, you know, maybe even have a little controversy. Like, if you disagree, it's even better. With each other, not with me, of course. But so my first question, let me put it to you this way. When he and I were sitting there talking about what, you know, if you're going to write a column about math for the really, the well, not the broadest public, it's the public that reads the New York Times, so that's already a certain section. But still, what should it be? Now, one of us at lunch said, well, this is a newspaper we're talking about, so it should be about the news. And there's a lot of math in the news all the time. You can think about like the hidden mathematical stories behind climate change or about what's happening in the economy, or there's things in healthcare that are mathematical. So there's always math lurking in the news. Why not make it topical math? The other of us at lunch said, no, that doesn't seem like such a good idea. How about starting at kindergarten or preschool and just slowly walk the reader through, you know, from kindergarten, go through, start with numbers, addition, subtraction, just grind your way forward through the whole curriculum, through high school, maybe even into college level math, just go like that. So first question is, which one of us do you think said which thing? go ahead, yes. So you say he would suggest going through the curriculum, and I suggested doing math in the news. Does that seem obvious? Pretty much everybody thinks, no, these people are saying no, they don't think so. Okay, well, there is an answer to this question. And the answer is, you're right. I think I'm jiggling my microphone a lot. Excuse me for 1 second here. I'm just going to do this. Maybe I'll turn around. The joy of X, not supposed to be X-rated. Okay, so anyway, he said to me, that's really what I want. He said, come on, readers don't know anything about math. And he spoke about his own experience. He had been an English major at Williams College, and he said, Look, I took algebra and geometry, and I even took calculus, but I never knew what was going on. I never really understood what those subjects were about or why I was learning them. Not to say I flunked the subjects. I could pass. I could even get a decent grade, he told me. And I could believe it. He's a smart guy, and he could do what the teacher told him and get a good grade. But he said, I never had any feeling for it. So I think a lot of readers are in that position. Can't you just walk us through the curriculum and tell us what it was all about. So to me, that was a fantasy, you know, that's exactly what any math professor wants to do. And, you know, I could hardly believe it. Seriously, that's what you want me to do? I could do that. Yes, that's what he wants me to do. All right, so my next question to you then is, let's suppose we've now agreed that that's how it's going to be. Who's the audience for something like this? And I'll just keep that question fairly open. Anyone want to suggest, like, think about this realistically. Who is going to read something like that? Or who should it be aimed at? Educators? So I'm writing for who? High school teachers?
People who hate math.
People who hate math.
People who do crossword puzzles.
People who like crossword puzzles.
Parents.
Parents is an interesting answer. I mean, think about that. In real life, most people encounter math because their kids are taking math. Isn't that true? I mean, that's really where, we all know, speaking realistically, that I know this is going to get me in trouble, but you saw that horrendous column the other day about why you don't need algebra. But except that a lot of what he said was true, that's the unpleasant thing, that my colleagues will not like me saying it, because I love algebra as much as the next person, but there's some uncomfortable truths in what this Andrew Hacker said, that a lot of people never do use math the rest of their life after school, and they live perfectly productive and even happy lives. So, except when their kid says, you know, how do I do lattice multiplication? And this happened to me. My kids asked me that. I never learned lattice method. I don't even, you know. So they had to teach me the lattice method. I learned what they call the old school method. So this is what it must be like for all kinds of parents. Their kids are constantly hitting them with math that they never had. And so that would be a natural audience to try to help the parents. Yeah. And, well, have we missed anyone? People in the humanities, like the editor himself. Yeah. And also kids would be a very interesting audience. Now, these are not necessarily all compatible with each other, right? So you would have to make a choice. There's one audience that people didn't mention. It's interesting that you didn't mention it, which are fellow mathematicians. That is, one could think, again, trying to be realistic, that the only people who are going to read this are people who already like math. And so why not just be honest about it and write for them? And since, after all, nobody is ever writing for them in the New York Times. They have their own journals, but, you know, like if you look at the Tuesday Science Times, never any math. There's all this stuff about your body, your psychology. There's stuff about, you know, quarks and the solar system, but basically never math. So anyway, so these were some possible choices. And my feeling was that I would try to write for a friend of mine. That is, I wanted to think about a particular person. And so I mentioned this person in the first column. Let me show you what I said. I mean, I thought that this would be helpful to imagine a real person. Anyway, let me read it to you just in case you're having trouble. It says, I have a friend who gets a tremendous kick out of science, even though he's an artist. Now, let me interrupt there for 1 second. Sorry, now that it's up there, you're going to want to read it. This is an example of what happens when you have to write on a deadline. I might have phrased that first sentence a little differently now that I think about it. That is, why am I saying even though he's an artist? I have a friend who gets a tremendous kick out of science, and he's an artist. But the implication was somehow that, you know, an artist wouldn't naturally, that's sort of interesting that he likes science and he's an artist. Well, anyway, whatever. So, gets a tremendous kick out of science even though he's an artist. Whenever we get together, all he wants to do is chat about the latest thing in evolution or quantum mechanics. But when it comes to math, he feels at sea and it saddens him. The strange symbols keep him out. He says he doesn't even know how to pronounce them. In fact, his alienation runs a lot deeper. He's not sure what mathematicians do all day. Well, I could tell him about that. Or what they mean when they say a proof is elegant. Sometimes we joke that I should just sit him down and teach him everything, starting with 1 + 1 = 2, and going as far as we can. Crazy as it sounds, over the next several weeks, I'm going to try to do something close to that. I'll be writing about the elements of math from preschool to grad school, for anyone out there who'd like to have a second chance at the subject. but this time from an adult perspective. It's not intended to be remedial. The goal is to give you a better feeling for what math is all about and why it's so enthralling to those who get it. So this is true. I was thinking about my friend, and when I would meet with him, he always wants to talk about science, but math just, he can't get it because he doesn't have the language. So I sort of thought I'm going to try to write for him or people like him, curious people who are grown-ups and who want a second chance. So, and then as you can see, maybe it begins with preschool. So let me give you an example then of the kind of math that's in there. That is, the natural place to start is preschool, and the first thing that we encounter as young children is numbers, you know, counting. And it seemed to me that this has never been done better than Sesame Street. So in particular, I want to show you this little clip. This was something that I had watched with my kids. We have two daughters who, you know, at one time we used to watch this kind of thing with them. And so here it is. This is a character named Humphrey. This is Ernie and Ingrid. And they're working at a hotel. So here, watch what happens. Well, you'll see. They're going to get an order, a lunch request from a room full of penguins at the beginning. Here we go.
Man,
hold on. It's for you, Humphrey.
Mm-hmm.
Here you go.
Thank you. Yellow, furry arms, how may I help you?
We're hungry.
Ah, well, what would you like?
A fish.
Fish?
A fish.
Fish?
Fish.
Fish?
How about you guys?
Fish.
Fish, fish.
You got it?
Well, let me repeat that. Fish, fish, fish. Fish, fish, fish.
You got it!
All righty. Be right up with that order, Mr. Penguin, sir.
Yum.
Ingrid, go tell the kitchen. Fish, fish, fish. Fish, fish, fish.
Fish, fish, fish. Fish, fish.
No. Fish, fish, fish. Fish, fish, fish.
Not that easy an order, but I'll get it.
Excuse me, Ingrid and Humphrey, I have a better way for you to do this.
A better way?
Mm-hmm.
What do you mean?
Well, I just think it would be easier if you, count the fish.
Count them?
Really?
Mm-hmm. Look, I'll show you. Humphrey, you tell me the order, and I'll count with you.
Alrighty. Fish.
One.
Fish.
Two.
Fish.
Three.
Fish.
Four.
Fish.
Five.
Fish.
Six. See there? See what did I tell you? Now you know how many fish to send up. Six fish.
Holy mackerel! Mm-hmm. This counting thing can really save a person a lot of trouble.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah. Does it work on other stuff? Say, cinnamon rolls?
Yep.
Cream pies?
Sure.
Spark plugs?
Absolutely.
Wow.
Wow.
He did it again. He may be the smartest person in the whole world.
Mm-hmm.
All right, Ingrid, let's go get those. What are they again?
Fish.
Fish.
It's a great clip, and the point I was trying to make by showing it, by the way, this series was online, so it was possible to show this. That is, in the print paper, you can't do this. But on the web, you can embed a video, and so there it was, and people who thought of it could click on it. Now, what's the lesson from Humphrey and Ingrid there? Well, the first thought you would get, I suppose, anyone want to tell me? Actually, what do you get from that? Oh, yes, here's a young person. Excuse me, the penguins like fish. That's good. That's a good science conclusion. Yeah, so you can learn some biology from this, too. Right, penguins like fish. What about a mathematical lesson? Yes? Math is a source of convenience. So that's a first lesson, right? That you can say fish, 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 and it starts to be inconvenient and also can lead to confusion because you saw Ingrid only said it five times. So the concept of six could save time and be convenient and also help avoid confusion. So there's like three good practical reasons for having a number. Then there's a deeper point that's made that I noticed you all laughed at, but it's a really interesting philosophical point. Did you hear what came next after they count them? Yes? Yeah. Did you hear that remark? You can assign the same value to different objects. So, the befuddled Humphrey says, does it work for cinnamon rolls and spark plugs? So notice there's an abstraction there, that the concept of six is more abstract than six fish. Six is a concept that lives in some higher philosophical realm than six fish or six spark plugs. We don't have to talk about six objects. We can just think of the abstract concept of six. So you start to, now, okay, this doesn't seem so abstract to you, but maybe when you were little, it did. That is, numbers are more abstract than objects. And you start to realize that abstraction is a powerful thing because it generalizes to other objects. So that was what this first piece was about, was the power of abstraction and also the philosophical murkiness of the question, where do numbers come from? That is, are numbers inventions? Are people inventing numbers, or are we discovering numbers? Are they out there in the universe waiting for us to find them, or is it just a purely, is it like writing poetry, that we're just creating something that wasn't there before? So, and there are reasonable arguments on both sides of that, but in any case, whether you think they're invented or discovered, numbers have this odd property that once they're brought to life, they have properties of their own that you can't control. They start to have lives of their own, like they're sort of like little animals that obey rules. For instance, two odd numbers, when they add together, will always make an even number. And you can't avoid that. That's just inherent in the concept of numbers. So this was a chance to get a little bit philosophical in that first column. Now, the question then was, how's this going to go over with the public? And it turned out that it went over surprisingly well. There were about 500 comments on this first piece, which was a lot, and almost all of them very, very positive. People saying how grateful they were that the Times was going over math and thank you. And also this phrase, a second chance at math, seemed to resonate with a lot of people, that, there's this uncomfortable truth that it's not that people don't know math, by and large, but that they're actually traumatized by their mathematical experiences. You know what I mean? That's a pretty bad thing that we do to people. That is, they come away feeling stupid or ashamed of themselves, and then they have to make uncomfortable jokes the rest of their life. Oh, I was never any good at math, or, I can't calculate the tip. So it's more than just not learning math. There's some kind of real ego deflation that happens. And so this idea that, hey, maybe I can recover, I could have a second chance, that seemed to appeal to a lot of readers. So anyway, the next question then is, now speaking as a communicator, what should be, as we go on in this series, what should be the emphasis? Like here I did some philosophical stuff, it's very low level. Should we be talking about ideas? Should we talk about, let me ask you, what do you think would make a plausible way to do a series about math? What should be the emphasis? What are some possible themes? Yes? Okay, the comment is, why do you need to learn it? That it's almost a universal objection. Where am I ever going to use this in my life? Why do I need this? What's the good of it? So I could try to constantly answer that question, how this will help you or why you need it. Almost like it happened here, that numbers are useful shortcuts. Yes, there was a hand went up back there, yes? Why you would want to learn it. Not why you need to learn it, but want to. Like, what do you have in mind? So nice. Why would it be so nice to learn it? So do you mean something like, if someone says, they don't say to you, you need to learn music because it's good for you. You want to learn music because it will make you happy, or something like that. That is, it's more like music than like learning to tie your shoes. Yeah. Some other thoughts? Yes. Yeah, just to get people to understand things that they didn't understand the first time. So, certainly when I was thinking about it, I thought of ideas like that. Should it be about the ideas of the subject? One argument against that is that it makes math very disembodied if we just focus on ideas, that these were ideas that were thought of by real people. So one should, in fact, make the subject come alive by telling history, struggles, make it personal. I did not do that because it's my experience that people don't find history of math interesting unless they already like math to begin with. And so I didn't tell any stories about history of math, which was painful for me because I love that subject, but there's almost none to be found in the series. Another natural thought would be there should be puzzles. Like if you see how Martin Gardner used to approach math in Scientific American in his mathematical games section, it was always about puzzles. And there's a huge audience for that, but I never asked any puzzles. I figured my reader, when I think of my friend, he didn't want me to ask him a puzzle. He just wanted me to explain the math he didn't understand the first time. So anyway, that was the emphasis throughout. Just going to be about ideas. How about the question of equations? Math requires equations. Are we going to show them? Or are we going to try to get by without them? I tried to avoid them. People get really bothered by those symbols, especially in Greek. But I think you can convey a lot of math without the equations. Now, sometimes you need them, but by and large, I tried not to. And so as an example of that, there's also the question, what about proofs? If you ask the average working mathematician, what is the heart of the subject? A pure mathematician would say theorems and proofs. That's what makes math different from science. We can prove things. We know things for all time. And there's a lot of truth to that. And I sort of agree with that. Proofs, even though I'm not a pure mathematician myself, I'm more, involved in applying math to the real world, or some ideal version of the real world. I am a mathematician. I do feel like arguments and proofs are a key part of our subject, but they should be done with pictures as much as possible. So here's an example of that kind of thing. Here's a proof of something that you probably learned, in fact, I'm sure you learned, in high school, which is the area of a circle. So you might have memorized the formula that the area of a circle is pi r squared, right? R is the radius. That's the distance from the center out to the circle. And so if you remember what proof you saw of that, you probably didn't see a proof because your teacher didn't show you one. And the reason is because the proof needs something like calculus. And so you wouldn't have seen that in geometry because you're taking geometry, not calculus. So you might say, wait a second, really? Come on, that's one of the most basic facts of geometry. I really need calculus? Yes, you do, because circles are round. So what do I mean? That they're not made of straight lines. The geometry proofs that you did were all about things with straight lines, the area of a square, the area of a triangle. Those things have straight lines. But circles are not made of straight lines. They're round. And you can't really properly calculate the area of a circle until you know ideas of calculus. And so here's a kind of baby version of calculus that lets you see why the area is pi r squared. So there's a circle. And on the top, it's chopped into four pieces. Now, I've rearranged these pieces to make this weird scalloped shape, which, what I like about this proof is it starts out looking very bad. You'd think, this is not helping. I mean, I've moved those four pieces around to make this shape. How is that better? Now I have to figure out the area of this thing. That looks worse. Yes, it does. But there are a few things we can notice about it. One is, remember I said that radius is this length that going from the center to the rim of the circle. So that's this right here. I've marked it as r. And then we did define pi. I didn't say that yet. But earlier in the column, I mentioned what pi means. It's the ratio of the circumference of a circle to the diameter. So remember this thing, circumference is 2 pi r. You might have learned that at some point. So here what I'm showing is that in this picture, it's allowed to say that this bottom half of the circumference, these two arcs, that's half the circumference because the other half is up here on top. So there's half the circumference, pi r down there, and pi r on the top. All right, so that's what we know so far. Now, it doesn't look like it's any good, but then comes the brainstorm, which is, I only used 4 pieces. What would happen if I used more pieces? So there it is with 8 pieces. And I've done that same peculiar construction where I'm wedging those little pie sectors next to each other. And maybe you can start to see the shape doesn't look quite as bad. Still doesn't look great. Looks like some kind of weird worm or something. But anyway, it's getting better in that this part is not as bumpy. It's a little bit flatter. And this side is not as tilted as it was. It's almost standing straight up. Here's what happens if I make it 16 slices. You start to see what's going on? What's happening there? The calculus, yes, but we're adding more and more slices. But imagine that, so this column was supposed to show you, do you want to, go ahead, I know you know the answer.
It's approximating a rhombus.
It sort of looks like a rhombus. Good, it does look like a rhombus. What the heck, a rhombus? That's something with straight lines that are parallel, and then this side would be parallel to this side. It is approximating a rhombus, but let me go back one. Did you notice, compare the slope of this side. That's pretty slopey. And notice it's starting to stand straighter up, and now even more straight. So it's not actually approximating a rhombus, yes it is. But in the limit, if I took infinitely many of those infinitely thin wedges, do you see what it would become? It'd become a rectangle, yes, that's right. That's what, now, then notice, by the way, though, that the this side always was r, because it's always a radius of the wedge, and this part was always half the circumference, so it's always pi r. So when it finally becomes a rectangle out at infinity nirvana, yeah, right, that deserves a chuckle. But you know what I mean, if we could imagine taking more and more of these little slices and letting them get arbitrarily thin, it would ultimately approach a rectangle with dimensions pi r and r, and so the area of a rectangle would be pi r times r, pi r squared. And so that's really why the area is pi r squared. That's one way of seeing it. And I didn't need to use a whole lot of formulas. All I need, though, is the help of infinity. Now, usually you think of infinity as a mind-boggling thing that is not your friend. But it is your friend. And when you learn how to tame infinity, that's the point. You've got to tame infinity like the best domestic horse you could imagine. You know, that is, there's tremendous horsepower in infinity. And so if you can tame it, and it doesn't run wild and stomp on you, which it can, then you can, that's calculus. That's the systematic taming of infinity. Seriously, that's really the big new idea in calculus, how to control infinity. So if you've taken calculus and you learned about derivatives and integrals, those were ways of managing infinity in different guises. So anyway, here's an example of calculus in action, using the power of infinity. So I do feel like you need proofs in this series, and I tried to show them. I actually tried to show one proof or one argument of that style in every piece. And it turns out that if you do it the right way, people won't mind. Like, you notice I use a lot of colors. I think it helps. It's more interesting with the colors. I should say thank you to Margie Nelson. Some of you may know Margie is an artist, a scientific illustrator in town, and she's the one who said, why don't we use color? That's a good idea. So we did. These pieces were pretty successful in the sense that people started emailing them, and every week they made the top 10 most emailed. Out of the 15 weeks, they were 15 for 15. Sometimes they were number 2 most emailed. So that was all very encouraging, but then there was a strange sociological thing that started to happen that I didn't see coming. It got very interesting, which is there's this whole section of comments where readers can say stuff. And they availed themselves of that opportunity. And there started to be a split in the reader population. You can see it, the comments are still up on the web. There were the people who were, let's say, the little people who I was writing for, and they were still saying, thank you for writing this, and that was a nice proof, or I love that. But then there were the other people who were my colleagues. at least in spirit, who were saying that, you know, lots of them would add improvements or corrections, which is, that's good. We're after the truth here, so there's no ego in this. We're just trying to get it right. So people would sometimes suggest better ways of thinking about stuff, but they often did it in a way that, let's say, was sort of repellent to the other people. That is, they would carry on at great length showing better proofs or filling up the page with algebra. And they even started talking to each other. Certain readers would say, you know, stop doing that. This series is for us. And it got very interesting. So there was a key moment, at least for me, psychologically in the series, when I showed an example that led one reader to say that the series has now jumped the shark. Now, I didn't know that expression, jump the shark. And I'm guessing that people of a certain age will not know what that means, whereas people of a different age will know what it means. So anyone who knows, you want to give us a rough definition of that? Yes?
Yeah, so it comes from Happy Days, when basically there was this really popular character who was out water skiing one day, and he took his skis and he jumped over a shark, and that's when people were like, I can't watch this.
Okay, so Emily, just to repeat the comment, that in the TV show Happy Days, the character Fonzie, who was the greaser, the show had gotten stale. It was popular for a long time, and the feeling was we need to do something to juice it up. So they had this character water skiing over a shark, and it was so ridiculous, you know, as a way of trying to make something that was stale become lively again, that the expression has now come about, that when you start to do something bizarre that's uncalled for just to spruce things up, you've jumped the shark. So anyway, after I looked up the term and saw that this reader felt I had jumped the shark, I got a little worried about that. You know, by the way, I did not read the comments. As a general practice, I didn't read them. My wife would read them for me. Because I did have these deadlines, and I felt like if I read them, I'll get very defensive. I have thin skin, and I'll want to start arguing with the person or get sulky and depressed, and I can't write. So, but I had to write something for the next week, so I felt like I better not read these comments, just keep writing. But she would say, my wife would say, well, oh, most of the comments were good. There were a few, as she would call them, pontificators. But, you know, don't worry, nothing lethal. But anyway, when this jump the shark thing came about, let me show you what provoked it. Because I think actually I deserved it. That is, I did jump the shark a little. I didn't jump, that's not actually accurate. What I did was I did something too hard too early. In a very early column, I did this. So this is in the sort of, you know, lessons learned. Like this is supposed to be a talk about communication and try to communicate math to the public. Here's something I think I learned. So I was trying to write about geometry. I had written something about the Pythagorean theorem. But then I thought, let's teach people a little bit more modern geometry. And so I mentioned that, you know, you don't have to do just geometry in the plane, which is where high school geometry takes place. You can also think of geometry on curved surfaces, like there's one, the Earth. You know, like if you've ever flown to Europe from around here, say from Newark or New York City, you probably notice that it typically the flight path looks something like this, that they start here in New York, then they hug the coast, they go up past Nova Scotia, and you know, then down south of Ireland, and then this is going to Rome. Well, foolishly as a kid, I used to think this is because the pilot wants to play it safe, and you know, if something happens, he could go back to Canada. So he's going to stay close to Canada. That's not really the reason. If you take out a globe, if you have a globe at home and look at it and try to look with your eye, what's the shortest way to get from New York City to Rome, and try to do the straightest thing you can, given that you're curving on the surface of the Earth, you'll see that this is the shortest path, that's all. It's the analog of a straight line on a plane. It's a curved, it's what we would call an arc of a great circle. So anyway, I tried to teach a little about what do we mean by straight lines on surfaces that are not flat, thinking that this example on the Earth would be pretty familiar. So far, so good. But then One of my friends had mentioned to me that there was a very cool video of the shortest paths on a shape that we in math like called a double hole torus. And And I thought that was great. I saw this video and I thought, oh, I want to show that. I'm going to write the column around this video. That is, the column will be an excuse to show this certain video. There's the double hole torus. But that wasn't the simulation I liked. It was this one. Okay, here's a little motorcycle. And you'll notice that there's no rider. It's just a motorcycle that's driving itself. And its handlebars are locked in the straight position. There's no steering involved. And it's this bike is just going to go straight ahead at all times. You get the idea. Now, what's that showing? That's supposed to show if you were taking the shortest path, always following a straight line on this weird surface, that would be implemented by having a motorcyclist who doesn't turn the handlebars. And then you saw the weird-looking paths on this weird surface. Well, this was the shark jumping, because apparently this didn't make much sense to most people, even though I tried to explain it. And I came to the conclusion that there were certain things that I could get away with and certain things I couldn't. So here's what I believe I learned. And I think it might generalize to anyone else if you ever have occasion to write for the public about some specialized subject, that I found that if I wrote about something that was abstract but familiar, it was okay. Like, say, that proof with the circle, the pi r squared. Sort of abstract. I'm not trying to connect it to anything real. We're just calculating the area of a circle. We're using infinity. Feels like we're just in a math class. But because it's so familiar and everyone has already seen pi r squared and had it beaten into them in high school, they feel like I know kind of what's going on and they'll put up with it. So abstract is okay if it's familiar. Or if you do something very unfamiliar, then it better be concrete. So, for example, I did one piece about a complicated thing in probability theory called Bayes' formula, or Bayes' rule for Bayesian statistics. And it's confusing. It has to do with conditional probability, and it's important, but it's confusing to explain the difference between probability of A given B or probability of B given A. It's a little bit mind-bending. But I was able to talk about it in the context of women going in for mammogram screening and, to see if they might have breast cancer. And there are certain statistics about, what are the odds that a woman who has breast cancer will test positive, or she doesn't have breast cancer, she might still test positive through a false positive, and so on. So it's a really important, serious, very concrete problem that is motivating to try to understand. Does this woman who's been told that she has breast cancer, she's been told she tests positive, how worried should she be? Given that in her risk group, that she has no risk factors, she's young, et cetera, it's very, very unlikely that she's actually got cancer, yet she tested positive. So anyway, it turns out that if you do something, this is a hypothetical case, so I'm not gonna tell you what happens to the woman, there's no actual woman in the story. But as far as what happens to the math communicator, if you do something that is concrete but unfamiliar, that's okay too. The public will go for that. What you cannot do is something that is abstract and unfamiliar. You can't do both. Then you're jumping the shark or you're just losing the readers. So anyway, that was, for me, a little bit of a lesson. I guess at this point, maybe I'll talk just a little bit about this book that I have coming out. the joy of X that Bud mentioned. And unless you want to ask anything or make any comments at this point before I move along, yes, please?
This is from a philosophy
meeting. Oh, good, yes.
Does the motorcycle ever come back to its originating place, or does it just go?
There's a wonderful question. The question was, it's a perfect question. Does the motorcyclist taking this strange winding path, always following a straight line on the torus, double torus, does this motorcyclist come back to his or her starting place or not? And the answer would be it depends on, I mean, it's sort of, there's for some of the paths, like going around, so to speak, the equator of this shape, the person would come back to their starting point. Whereas I think, let's make a little approximation. If it's a finite size motorcycle with a tire that's, 3 inches wide, yes, the person will eventually go over their original tread. But if it was a mathematical point with no dimension moving around, there would be certain paths where it would never come back to its original point. It would get arbitrarily close as you want to that point, but it wouldn't go through. So it could just keep going around forever without literally going back through that point. So it can do a lot of funny stuff. But you should be a mathematician with that kind of question. Seriously, that's exactly the question that we would want to ask. Yes?
I'm not sure what the difference is between a philosopher and a mathematician. My comment or question is this. People probably haven't all read the Hacker article, but the thing that he seemed to miss was precisely the point he made about counting, namely that algebra is a way of abstraction.
Okay. Yeah, so Mark makes this interesting comment about so some of you may not have seen, there was an op-ed on Sunday in the Times that was a full-page op-ed with the title, Is Algebra Necessary? By Andrew Hacker, a political science professor who is like apparently emeritus now, but who said that the gist of his message was that we shouldn't be teaching algebra to the extent that we are teaching it, because there are more valuable things that we could be doing. It's not that he doesn't want us to teach math. He just thinks that we should teach something he calls citizen statistics, which is the kind of practical math that would help you understand the consumer price index and inflation and whether Obama's affordable care will pay for itself or not. Things that really matter in politics and citizenship. Or to evaluate claims about did humans cause global warming or not, but then Mark says it's sort of an odd comment that Hacker is making, because part of what you learn in algebra is how to move beyond just pure numerical things to thinking about deeper abstractions like relationships between numbers, functions. And you can't really think about cause and effect in economics or climate, unless you have something a little deeper than numbers. You really would need ideas of algebra, and it would help to even have more than that. So that leads me into actually this next thing that I wanted to show, which is, so in The Joy of X, at the time that these columns were running, several publishers said, it seems like it might make a nice book. Would you like to write a book? So I did agree to write a book, and it's the same as the columns in a way, except that it's more. So there were 15 columns, and now there are 15 additional brand new pieces of the same type, which let me flesh out everything from kindergarten to graduate school the way I had hoped to in the first place, except that things that were missing the first time around, like I did addition, subtraction, and division, but no multiplication. Well, now I was able to write a little bit about multiplication. So one of the things that was missing the first time was an algebra topic. Here are some things that are beautiful about algebra. You've probably seen problems like this. This is one of these funny bathtubs that are only encountered in algebra class, where the cold water runs twice as fast as the hot water. Do you see it gurgling out of there? The hot water is just dripping. And it would take the hot water 1 hour to fill the tub if it were running by itself. But the cold water, which is faster, would fill the tub in a half hour. And so you can guess what the question is going to be. right? If they're both running at the same time, how long will it take for them to fill the bathtub? Well, this was a question that was very dear to my heart because my uncle, Irving, asked me this question when I was a kid. And I, you know, Uncle Irving always had questions for me. He liked asking puzzles. He wasn't a very popular person because he would do this to everybody. But I kind of liked it. And I might have been maybe 10 years old at the time or something. So he said, you know, Stephen, if, okay, takes this one takes a half hour to fill the tub, the other one takes an hour. How long will it take if they're both running together? And I said 45 minutes. I was 10 years old. Come on. Now, some of you might have been thinking 45 minutes because you're, okay, don't be too embarrassed if you did. It's completely wrong. But because you know, you're given two numbers, 30 minutes and 60 minutes, I'm going to take the average. And there are some circumstances where that might make sense. Like, for instance, suppose, you know, I'm an old man and it will take me 60 seconds to cross the street. But then there's a Boy Scout who sees me. And the Boy Scout walking on his own, it would only take him 30 seconds to cross the street. But he's going to help me. How long will it take when we walk together? That might take 45 seconds because I'm going to slow him down and he's going to speed me up. Okay, so sometimes the average might make sense in these cooperation problems. But the bathtub problem is different. It's a different problem than the Boy Scout and the old man problem. So how is it different? Well, Uncle Irving, you know, after he got through laughing at my 45-minute answer, said, no, Stephen, you should think about it like this. Think about how much water goes in the tub in 1 minute. Okay, the one that takes 30 minutes to fill the tub will fill 1/30th of the tub in 1 minute. Right? Because it takes 30 minutes to fill the tub. So 1/30th of the tub will be filled in 1 minute by that one, and the one that runs slower will fill 1/60th of the tub in 1 minute. So if they're running together, it'll take they'll fill 1/30th plus 1/60th. Which, okay, now that's already hard math, because then you have to know how to add fractions that don't have the same denominator. And you know, at some point in school, they teach you how to do that. That's what the least common denominator is for. So if you put them both over 60, then it's 2 over 60 plus 1 over 60. That's 3 over 60. Are you with me? I don't mean to insult you. I just want to make sure everyone's there. So anyway, yes, 3 over 60. That's 1 over 20, so it will take 20 minutes, as Uncle Irving explained to me, and that's right. Okay. Now, what I want to do is like a little theme and variations on this problem, because, you know, you sometimes hear people say, what I like about math is there's only one right answer. You ever hear anyone say that? Well, a lot of people don't like that about math. That is, they feel like it's a very rigid subject that stifles creativity. And in fact, this is a wrong statement. There might be one right answer, but there may be many right methods to getting the right answer. And so let's think about this problem like three or four different ways, because I think that this is part of what makes math beautiful, that there's so much room for invention. So for example, one thing I could have done, here's an example of how you can get partial information, which can be very valuable, without doing any work. Okay, you don't need to know algebra or even common denominators. Just by thinking, you can get some good information, like Sherlock Holmes style clues. You could say, for instance, one of them fills up the tub in 30 minutes. Suppose I don't even use the other one. I just use the one that fills it up in 30 minutes. Then I know it cannot possibly take longer than 30 minutes when the other one is helping. Okay, so now we know something. The answer has to be less than 30 minutes. That's partly why my answer was so ridiculous, of 45 minutes. That's completely absurd. Even the 30-minute one on its own will just take 30 minutes. Another thought you could have is, partly why the problem is hard is because it's asymmetrical, that there's the... they're going at different speeds. That's confusing. What if they went at the same speed? You're allowed to change the problem. You can do anything you want. You know, this is like you're just working secretly. You don't have to tell anybody. So you could say, what if the one that's going to take an hour, what if it was faster? What if it only took a half hour? So now I have two of them going that would each separately fill up the tub in a half hour on their own. So how long would they fill it up if they were both running at that same fast speed? 15 minutes, it's obvious, right? They're each doing half the work. But of course, that's not our original problem, because that would be two fast faucets that both take 30 minutes. So we know when it's fast, it will take 15 minutes. That'll be faster than our problem. So we now know that our problem has an answer somewhere between 15 and 30. Doing no work, just common sense. Isn't that nice? So that's pretty good. Now, you can do better, though, by really starting to be freaky imaginative. And that's what a lot of the people are like in the math department. I mean, that's really what it takes to be a mathematical poet or musician is, you know, you're going to just really be imaginative. And that's part of what makes this so fun, to be a mathematician, and which you don't get from reading Andrew Hacker's column. I mean, he has no idea what it's like to do math. Okay, but part of it is not his fault. I mean, part of it is that it's our fault as teachers, because we haven't shown this side of our subject to the average student. So here's an example of this. You may not like it, but I'm trying my best here, which is, here's a weird thought. Suppose that you imagine that the tubs can move around on conveyor belts, and they're going down an assembly line. Maybe I should say, why am I having this ridiculous, surreal idea with the conveyor belt? Because what's confusing with the original problem is that the fast and the slow water are getting in there, and they're sort of sloshing around together, and it's very confusing as they're getting mixed up with each other. So I don't like that. I want to conceptually keep the hot water separate from the cold water, and to do that, I'm going to give them their own faucet and their own set of bathtubs to fill. See what I did there by sort of separating them? So you don't need the conveyor belt picture. You could simply put it this way. Wait an hour, and let's see how many tubs get filled. Okay, the one of them will fill one tub per hour. The other fills two tubs per hour, because it takes only a half hour. So they're going to fill three tubs per hour, 20 minutes. That's it. So, okay, I'm glad some of you like that. I mean, Uncle Irving might not have liked that. That's not the officially correct way to do it. You're supposed to do common denominators, but I think that this is a fun, you know, way to think about it. Anyway, so word problems, yes. Word problems are one of the least popular subjects in algebra, but they do offer room for imaginative thinking if we teach them that way. I guess the last thing to say is I do have a new series of columns that will start sometime in September, and I'm working on them right now. I'm not sure how they're going to turn out. They're pretty rough at the moment, but I invite you to look at them and make nice comments, please. The theme this time around is not totally definite yet, but I think what it's going to be is the math about you. That is, math that is egocentric. Math that has to do with you, your body, your proportions, your organs, your fingerprints, your Facebook friend count. Well, it's all about you. So I was thinking of calling it Me, Myself, and Math. But I don't know. Another thought was You Math instead of YouTube, but I might get in trouble with YouTube. I don't know. Anyway, so we'll see. But so that's, I think I'm done. I'm sort of out of time. Maybe I'll stop there, and I don't have a big wrap up. I'm just going to stop. Thank you. Do you want to? Okay, we have some time for questions or comments if anyone wants to. Yes, please. Wow, you're really into it.
There's
a yes. Okay, the question is, when I was showing that motorcycle moving on that shape that looked sort of like a pretzel with two holes, is it related to a Mobius strip, which, as you guys will remember, is that thing you can make with a piece of paper where when you glue the strips ends together, before you glue them or tape them, you put a half a twist and then glue it together. So it sort of looks like that shape, except that, you know, maybe a Mobius strip looks like it has one hole that you could put your arm through. This would have two. But there's not an obvious relationship, but I think that we might be able to construct that double-holed torus by possibly gluing a certain number of Mobius strips together. No, probably not, because that surface has the property that it has an outside where the cyclist is driving, whereas the Mobius strip, you might remember, only has one side. You know, you move on what you think is one side, and then you go around, and now you're on the other side. So that's a surface that has only one side, whereas this surface has two sides. It might require a bit of work to relate them, but there could be possibly a connection. I don't see one offhand. Yes?
Of the original 15 columns that you wrote, which one was your favorite?
The question was, which of the 15 was my favorite? That's an interesting question. I haven't ever thought about that. I don't know. Did you read some of them? I don't know. I mean, I really did like that first one with Ernie and Humphrey. There's one at the end about infinity that was fun. That was the last one, about the Hilbert Hotel. I don't know. I don't know what to say. I like a lot of them. Yes, please.
So I was thinking about, at the beginning of your talk, about how the issue of some people liking math and some people having phobias about math.
Oh, yeah.
Bad experience and so as a person who, I love math, I was the daughter of a statistician, mathematician, but I have a lot of friends who are just like, oh my gosh, it's hated, and they're like, don't come near me with the math stuff. I'm wondering, do you think we could get teachers if most people would like it, or do you think it's just kind of intrinsic, you know?
It's a fascinating question. The question is that the world seems to divide into people who like math or who don't like math, or who either had generally positive experiences or something that gave them phobias about it. And do we think that did it have to be that way with different teaching? Like, let's say in some kind of paradise, could it be that everyone would like math if they were just taught right? Or could it just be that certain people intrinsically, as they say, don't have a head for math? What's my personal opinion, I guess, is the question. I'm going to give you a chicken answer here. The chicken answer is, I think a lot more people could like math than currently do. That we're nowhere near saturating the population. That is, the math expression would be that 1 minus epsilon, you know, of that is not like 99% of the people. I don't know what the number would be. I think realistically you could get 95% of the people to like math. But I do kind of believe that there are some people who would never like it. Maybe that's wrong. I don't know. I would love to believe you could get 100%. I kind of in my heart of hearts don't believe that. What do you believe?
How about if you change like to just appreciate?
Appreciate. I don't know. Do you think you could get 100% if the criterion was just appreciate? I still think you'd probably be stuck at 95%. Just because, you know, when you think of something even as universally loved as music, there are people who don't like music. It's kind of hard to imagine, but there are. And Leibniz said something about that music was like, that very close, well, a lot of people know music and math are intimately related in various ways. And so, the thought that there could be people who wouldn't like music makes me think there must be some people who would never like math. But I who knows? But we're nowhere near reaching that number. We're turning off a lot of people who could like it. Yes?
There's sort of a practical question about math education. Look at the home mortgage crisis and how many people took on loans where they didn't understand the effect of an interest rate or a variable interest rate. I wonder whether you'd advocate teaching in the elementary and secondary schools some manner that at least people would have some sort of defense of math.
Hmm. Yeah, there's the. Can everyone hear that question, or should I repeat it?
Please repeat.
Okay, we'll repeat it. The comment is roughly that there's so many things in real life where you could really be hurt by not understanding, like if you're taking a variable interest mortgage or something with a balloon interest rate, you know, or you could be cheated in all kinds of ways by people who are better at math than you are if they were unsavory characters. Couldn't we do something in either elementary school or middle school or high school to help people defend themselves just at that level? Do you remember being interested in mortgages? Because I remember not being. But I don't mean to make fun of your question, because I would like to say, yes, we could do something. But I think there's a certain problem that there are certain things that kids will find very hard to be interested in, and you can't really... I think you could do it maybe at a time when a person is ready to buy a house and give them a quick lesson then. It might be a better system for everyone to have an agent who's like a mathematical agent. You know, like when you go buy a car, for instance, I've seen people who bring their friend who's good with cars, you know, and then it's like, you can't fool me, my friend, you know. So if we had this army of mathematical people who could go around helping mortgage buyers and others, that could be a good job. I think that might be more practical. I don't know. I'm not really kidding. Oh, make it more entertaining. Well, maybe. I don't know. Okay, yes, please. Yeah, yes, you. The artist versus the scientist, yes. Oh, it looks like you're getting a microphone here. You don't want the microphone, okay. I can repeat the question. Let's see if I get the question. So you say in the first column there's this implied distinction between me writing as the math person to my friend the artist, but pretending that the two are separate, but in reality anyone who's writing has to be a little bit of a writer, artist. Is that the idea of the question? Yeah. Okay. Yeah, so the question is, as a person trained in math and scientific things, what was it like for me to try to wear a different hat and be a writer? And it's difficult for me. I don't write very easily, and I don't seem to have a good process. That is, I haven't figured out a good way to do it. It's more painful than it should be. My wife, who is an artist, says that she teases me that the approach I use would be like if I'm painting, I pull out the smallest brush and try to start painting the picture one little, you know, micron at a time. And then I decide I don't like that micron, so I start erasing that part. And she said, don't you know that you're supposed to use the big brush? And which I guess in writing means you write a big sloppy first draft and then you start editing it like your writing teacher taught you. And so I've tried doing that. I don't like it because there's such a big mess on the page. So it's really hard for me. I'll tell you one thing that I have found is helpful, because I never took a typing class and so I'm not good at typing, is I bought a program that is a speech to typing probe. It's called Drag and Dictate for the Mac. And so when I talk into it, I can talk all I want and it doesn't mind. And it just sits there typing. And when I'm done, there's a lot of garbage, but then I can edit, which I like. And so that's pretty helpful for me. And it also, it tends to give the pieces a conversational sound, which I like. They're not overwrought, I hope. Yes?
Have you resolved your own view on the controversy between whether math is discovered or...
Yes, I think I have. The question is, have I resolved my own view about is math discovered or invented? I think there's a pretty crisp formulation of that, which is that we invent the concepts, but we discover the consequences. That's not 100% right. Nothing ever is. But because, you know, some concepts are suggested by nature. For instance, when you see a round pebble, it makes you think of a circle. You know, it's not a perfect circle, but it's clear that nature is guiding you. Or the idea of a straight line or a flat, you know, thing that like this platform I'm standing on looks sort of like an abstract plane. So yes, things in nature guide us to certain concepts, but still, we're inventing the ideal concepts, but then deducing their properties. But that raises this tremendously fascinating philosophical problem of why does math work? You know, if we're really inventing the concepts, then it's like we're playing this game. How come we can predict the magnetic moment of the electron to 13 digits? And it really works. That's not just a game. There's something really working there. So how come? That's what's been called the unreasonable effectiveness of mathematics. And that's a very profound question that I don't want to get into. Yes?
There's so many interest in writing about math, like 1, 2, 3 elements of basic math. I can't remember his name, but the books are pretty popular. I'm sitting next to yours.
David Berlinski?
Yeah.
Yeah, David Berlinski has a book called 1, 2, 3.
Yeah.
Yep.
How valid you think his
approach
to math is?
I haven't honestly read his book, so I couldn't say. The 1, 2, 3 by David Berlinski is a book that I think tries to give a fairly thorough coverage, conceptual coverage of the beginnings of arithmetic. And I'm not sure how far does it go. Did you actually look at the book? You could tell us.
I listened to
it. Oh, you listened to it. Mm-hmm.
But I think that he's not really a sound mathematician, so I'm not sure he did an honest job.
I couldn't comment. I don't know. I do. No, not because I'm trying to be polite. Honestly, what happened was the publisher sent me an advanced copy of the book, but I never read it because I've been getting a lot of those lately. And I think because they see they think I'm a regular writer for the Times and I might write about their book, and you could imagine the scenario. Yeah. Does David Berlinski have a PhD in math? Possible. I'm not sure. Yeah, I think he might be in philosophy. I don't know. I haven't really looked at the book. He did write a very nice book, quirky book, called The Tour of the Calculus, which... Well, I read The Tour of the Calculus. I'd say I spent maybe 3 or 4 minutes reading parts of it, and I thought, no, I didn't read the whole book at all. I mean, I read a few. It's like Woody Allen, War and Peace, it's about Russia, you know. But A Tour of the Calculus is about calculus, and the bits of it I read, I thought that I would like to read more because he was very odd. He seemed to me very fresh, like he's not pulling out the standard hackneyed. He may be wildly wrong, I don't know, but he looked stimulating to me. So I think I could recommend him to in that way. He certainly looked interesting. I don't know beyond that. Yes?
So I have more of a comment than a question, which is that I don't really think it's divided into people who like or don't like math. I think it's more nuanced than that. That if something is a little difficult to grasp, then you are kind of nervous about it. You start to not like it because you're not necessarily good at it right away. Kind of a snowball. If it will last 40 years, I've been telling myself not good at math. I don't understand that. But I think your poem is that whole idea of the second chance or another look. I felt kind of like, oh. Maybe I can understand this.
Mm-hmm.
And like math, a little more effort. It doesn't come so easily, and then you translate that into
Yes. So the comment is that it's not just so simple as that we do or don't like math. It's more nuanced than that, and that what's really going on is that for some people, when they find that they're having a lack of success, it starts to get very discouraging. And there's also this feeling, which you didn't mention, but I bet you would agree, that math is often presented as cumulative, so that if you haven't learned this, you're now dead. That is, you're done. Okay, you might as well give up for the rest of your life, even though you have 7 more years of school or whatever it is, because you didn't learn long division. You know, now you're going to have trouble. And that's not really true, although there is a certain amount of truth to it, because if you have trouble with algebra, let's say, and you never got the idea of a variable, if you have to take trigonometry or pre-calculus or stuff with functions, you're going to really have trouble. So there is a certain unforgiving aspect to the way the curriculum is usually structured, that it's very sequential. And part of that is the nature of the subject. It doesn't have to be. There are places where, like for instance, if you couldn't do geometry, you might still be fine at algebra. You hear people say that, I was great at geometry, I hated algebra, or vice versa, you know. But it's funny, this aspect of the subject, because you don't hear it with reading or with literature. You know, I had a bad Russian literature teacher, so now I can't take, you know, Southern women writers. Yes, you can. You know, so there's no feeling of an unforgiving quality to lots of other subjects. And so we do have that disadvantage, and we probably should try to work harder against that. I do think that our curriculum is a little bit built from an earlier time when the country, I don't know if this is true, but I get the feeling that when we were trying to make lots of engineers and scientists for the space program in the 60s, that we said, you've got to learn calculus. And so if you look at our curriculum in high school and middle school, it's very much toward algebra, geometry, trigonometry, up to calculus. And nowadays, you know, computers are really important. And you could take a whole different track that would be more about computers and networks and probability and statistics. You still want these other things. You can't really understand those without the other subjects. But I think we've really got tunnel vision. It's like we're training everyone to be a pocket protector, black rim glasses, NASA engineer from 1960. And that's not 2012. And that's partly what I think Andrew Hacker was saying in his column, that I think there are a bit more points in there that are worth thinking about. I don't think he should be dismissed as quickly as math people are dismissing him, although he said it in such a belligerent and obnoxious way that I understand why people don't want to hear it. But there are some points there that are interesting. Yes, please, in the back.
Could you just review, how did your series wind up on the opinion pages of the Times and not somewhere else?
Not in the Science Times.
Yeah, and then I have one other question. I'm curious, after the comment that you accumulated after the series, you said they kind of broke into two camps. Mm-hmm. And does writing a new series now, do you have an audience that you're thinking differently about it now, about these two camps, or are you just writing just like you did the first time?
Yeah, okay. So the first question was, how did it end up being on the opinion page? And I think it's just a matter of personal relationships that it's like a little inside, you know, scientific publishing story here. But in 2003, I wrote a book for the public, my first attempt to write for this kind of audience, which I had an agent representing me, and the agent knew the editor of the op-ed page. And so I think he routinely asked the editor, will you consider an op-ed from one of my writers? And then you send it, and either they accept it or not. So that first piece that I wrote for the op-ed page got accepted. And over the years, the editor, who was about my age and sort of had kids about this, I mean, we just sort of naturally started to like each other. And so I think he just liked me. And so he said, you want it? And I don't know anyone that works for the Science Times. So I think it's like that. That's just who you know. But I noticed, too, that the op-ed page is doing more experimental stuff lately. You may have seen they have these columns on philosophy called The Stone. They have draft about writing. They had one called line by line about drawing. So they just seem to be taking more chances, or at least have a broader scope than the science page. But then the other question you had was, how am I thinking about this new series in terms of an audience or whatever? And I'm a little worried about it, honestly, because I already did this preschool to grad school line, this very simple trajectory so that people would know where they were. And I could go back and start again at preschool and say, you get another, you know, you get a third chance. But something about that feels wrong, especially because this book that I have coming out tries to do that. So I'm trying to do something different. One thought was to talk about politics, but not current politics, but transcendent. That is, there are mathematical principles about voting or about the way we partition, you know, regions, what's the right way to gerrymander or not gerrymander. I mean, you could think about political issues or how to take a census. So I thought I could write something about math as it applies to the country, and that would be very timely. But then I thought, but I don't know anything about that. And that's not necessarily a problem. You can always learn stuff. But I felt it was too dangerous. And also I thought people might need a break from politics. So then I thought, maybe if I write about you, how math applies really to you, maybe I can get that same audience without treating them like preschoolers. But I'm worried about it, because as I write these pieces, they seem hard. So I'm a little scared that they're gonna be a dud and people are gonna, you know, it's like a sophomore slump, you know, that these might be a big dud. That's what I'm worried about. But maybe not, I don't know, you never know. Maybe we should just take one last question and then let people leave if they need to get going. Yes, please. Oh, a little preview of what's in the new book? Well, there's a picture of the cover. The Joy of X, that's supposed to be an X. And the designer had fun with the X, as you can see. And at first we thought, we didn't like the cover, my wife and I, because of, it sort of looked like a screensaver. Like a really bad screensaver from about 10 or 20 years ago. But I asked the designer, could she explain the cover? And she said that she was inspired by something where I was talking about complex numbers in the book, where I talked about when you multiply by I, that's equivalent to a 90-degree rotation. And that I mentioned that that it's useful to electrical engineers and people who study electricity and magnetism, that the electric and magnetic fields are often 90 degrees out of phase. And so she said what she did is she rotated the X by 90 degrees and showed all the colors of the electromagnetic spectrum. So this was her thinking about I and 90 degrees and electricity and magnetism and colors. You know, that light is unified, but, you know, so she's got a lot of thoughts there, but it still looks like a screensaver to me. The other thing is that she's using the font that Julia Child uses for The Joy of Cooking. You may recognize that the joy. So apparently she thought this reference to the joy of sex is too in the gutter, you know. So let's bring it to cook to the kitchen. Joy of X. So, but anyway, as far as what's in the book, well, this is an attempt to partition math into what I thought were the big basics, which are numbers, what you would think of as arithmetic, elementary school. Moving to algebra, which I see really as, if you had to summarize in one word, it's the study of relationships, cause and effect, dose and response, input and output, supply and demand. I mean, that's why you really want to learn algebra from an applied point of view, as well as more abstract relationships. Geometry is obviously about shapes and their properties. And then calculus, if you had to say in one word, is really about change, how things can change. And so it goes through multivariable calculus and differential equations. And then probability and statistics and networks, data mining, that's data. You know, data gets talked about a lot nowadays, big data. So that's an attempt to talk about data a little bit. And then the frontiers is everything all over again, but modern. So calculus becomes the subject we call analysis. Numbers becomes number theory. algebra becomes group theory and more sophisticated. So this is, you know, graduate school or college level math. So that's not really the frontiers. It's actually what you could take here as a math major. But there is work being done at the frontiers of the subject in all those areas. So it's an attempt to show some of that. And each chapter is short. It'll take 5 or 10 minutes to read. It's the same as the columns. I have to say, I'm really happy with the book. I really think it's good. But we'll see what anyone else thinks. All right, thank you.
This has been a production of Cornell University on the web at cornell.edu.